You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
Come all you Texas Rangers, wherever you may be. I'll tell you of some troubles that happened unto me. My name is nothing extra, so that I will not tell. And here's to all you Rangers, I'm sure I wish you well.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal and I am an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today is Jordan Poss, instructor of history at Piedmont Technical College, newly relocated to Fountain in South Carolina. That is, you are relocated and not Piedmont,
yeah.
Right?
Yes.
So I got to ask, how are you liking the new digs?
Awesome. It's nice and quiet. I was telling you before we were recording that it's so quiet. An owl kept us awake the first two nights we were there.
Now, the important small town question, of course, is do you have a Walmart, and how much do you love it?
How much do I love the Walmart or the town?
Walmart, of course.
Oh, it's a nice Walmart. It's a considerably different demographic from Greenville, but it reminds me a lot more of home. Fountain Inn does not have its own Walmart. We just drive, 6 minutes up the road to Simpsonville.
Okay.
So it preserves a little bit of that small town flavor, but something like Walmart is still convenient.
Right, but it doesn't have one, so the town hasn't quite made it yet.
Not quite, but it's on the 385 corridor between Greenville and Clinton and Columbia, so it's going to turn into a just hive of hipsters and yuppies probably in the next 10 years.
Fair enough. I guess that's the world we live in now. I don't tend to think of hipsters as moving south. I tend to think of them as moving northeast and northwest and maybe to Wisconsin or Minnesota, but I suppose they've been around long enough that...
Well, they trickle down the mountains from Asheville and kind of pool in the Greenville area.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Asheville. No one who doesn't have family in the Asheville area would know anything about that, but yeah, it is kind of a hipster town, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
It's not necessarily unrelated, talking about things changing for the better or for the worse with what we're talking about today. So Jordan pitched, it's been a while, right, since you pitched this idea of a show on the new movie Highwaymen, which I don't know if I would assume our listeners automatically know what this is, just because of the way movies are released anymore. This didn't get a theatrical release, at least I don't think it did.
I think I might have gotten a minor one, two theaters in L.A., similar to, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs or Outlaw King.
That may be. So certainly not the widespread. I mean, it's not a Marvel movie, and it's not even it's not even Ride Along 2, right? It's a Netflix movie that got its release on Netflix. We'll throw a link to the trailer up in the show notes. I suppose the most... guess what? The most standout-ish thing about it is it's starring Robin Hood and Woody. For those of our listeners who grew up in the late 80s and 90s, Woody Harrelson and Kevin Costner are the co-leads on this. Well, Jordan, why don't you just give us a brief overview of what the movie's about?
Okay, the basic summary, basic plot summary, that is. It's the story of Bonnie and Clyde, roughly the last 3 or 4 months of their careers of crime. But told from the point of view of the Texas Rangers who tracked them down and killed them. That's the elevator pitch version of it. it's very much, and we'll talk about this more, I'm sure, but it is very much a corrective to the kind of romanticized vision of Bonnie and Clyde that has pertained, especially since the 1960s.
Right.
So rather than the kind of glitz and glamour of this, kind of counterculture Romeo and Juliet with machine guns, it's about these kind of fuddy-duddy, hard-bitten, retired frontier lawmen just kind of doing the hard shoe-leather work of tracking down bad people.
Right. Beating evidence out of witnesses and...
Yeah. There's less of that than in the movie Public Enemies, but I think that's... Because Public Enemies tried something similar and face-planted, I think.
It was that Johnny Depp movie.
Yeah, which tried to, don't get me started on Public Enemies, but it was made in the tail end of the Bush presidency, so you get a lot more of this federal agents beating people tied to chairs and, you know, all this kind of Abu Ghraib stuff.
Sure.
There's one or two incidents of that in this movie, but that's the stuff that feels the most Hollywood phony baloney. But I'm sure we can talk about that as we get there.
Sure. And when you pitch this, I hopefully I told you this. So you're gonna have to sort of do the heavy lifting here because I know nothing about Bonnie and Clyde. I know almost nothing about sort of romanticized criminals. That's just not an area of interest. And even law enforcement is kind of one of my weak areas.
Gotcha.
So this could all be completely made up, or it could be a completely true movie, and I would never know. So I'm relying on you here whatever you tell me, I'm just going to believe. I suppose we should start with just what the heck is a highwayman anyway, and why is it, you know, worth naming a movie after?
I was actually curious about this title myself because highwayman classically is a bandit. If you've ever seen what's the Kubrick movie, Barry Lyndon. Barry Lyndon gets stuck up by a highwayman at one point in that. And it's, you know, this kind of, you know, drawn flintlock pistols, you know, stand and deliver, that kind of thing. That's kind of classically what a highwayman is. Apparently, this is not a piece of slang I'm familiar with, but they drop it a couple of times in the movie. Apparently, it's sort of a archaic Western term for somebody who's essentially like a highway patrolman. Because the two main characters, Mani Gault, played by Woody Harrelson, and Frank Hamer, who's this kind of legendary Texas Ranger, played by Kevin Costner, the Rangers have been disbanded by Ma Ferguson, who's this kind of one of these kind of fantastically corrupt Depression era state governors, kind of like Huey Long in a dress, if you want to put it that way.
Was she? I mean, I didn't get corruption out of the movie, so was that?
No, that's all in the background. I think if you kind of know that's going on, you can get hints of it, but they really don't bring her into it that much.
Right.
But all of that's kind of going on. The reason that these Texas Rangers are in retirement at the beginning of the movie is because Ma Ferguson disbanded the Ranger Corps as being old fashioned because she was one of these kind of like progressive. You know, it's the South, and she's a Democrat, but she's like anti-Klan. She's a lot more kind of politically progressive and trying to like modernize sort of that New South sort of thing.
Right.
First female governor of a state at the same time as Wyoming, actually.
Yeah.
This is her second term that you see in the movie. So anyway, these Texas Rangers, they're no longer Rangers because the Ranger Corps has been disbanded as being kind of a relic of this kind of frontier past, which figures pretty prominently into later parts of the story in a character sense. So they're put they're not Rangers anymore. They're given what's called special highway assignment, where basically they're enlisted by the state corrections, headed by a guy named Lee Simmons, who's played by John Carroll Lynch. The husband from Fargo, if you've ever seen that.
Right.
He's a great actor. He's one of those "hey, that guy" actors.
He's the brother from Drew Carey is where I learned.
Oh, okay. he also plays the lead suspect for the Zodiac Killer in the movie Zodiac, which is
right.
If you're familiar with him from all those other more friendly roles, it's very off-putting to watch that. But anyway, all of this is like kind of real world political background, which I think they do a good job of condensing and summarizing. As you kind of hint to that, so they're brought in on special highway assignment, basically given jurisdiction within the state of Texas to try to hunt down these sort of highway robbers. So you know the title I think has an interesting ambiguity in that it's Hamer and Gault on all the posters, but it could is easily be referring to Bonnie and Clyde because they are the whole reason the story is being told.
Right. Who we don't actually see in the movie until the very end, right? I mean, we see them in silhouette from a distance sometimes, but I don't even know. Do they have any lines?
Yes. Bonnie Parker says, "Hey, honey," to somebody before she shoots him one time.
But her foot is on screen and she says something, or like you can see her. Yeah.
I think that's a pretty brilliant decision, honestly, because by the time they're such celebrities, you actually kind of get to see their celebrity from a distance like that. So when you're suddenly face to face with them at the end of the movie, the same way Hamer is, it is shocking and unnerving. I was disturbed by the final ambush myself.
I I was doing dishes, so I wasn't paying maybe as much attention as I should have. So I didn't quite get the disturbing thing for that purpose, although I think there were other reasons why we were supposed to have been disturbed by it, involving violence, yes, and brutality and what have you. But we'll get to that. Just to while we're on the Texas Rangers having been disbanded, another aspect is presumably these guys would have been retired anyway, because they are both elderly. I don't know how old they're supposed to be, but it's in their 60s at least.
Let me see exactly. I mean, they're not quite as old as they play with it, but they could have been comfortably retired by then. So
right.
Oh, Frank Hamer was born almost exactly 100 years before me. So by the time, he's like 50 at the time that
okay.
this is taking.
Okay, they play him up a little older than that then.
Yeah, but you know, 50 in 1934, if you're a former Texas Ranger, is probably a good
sure,
probably a good 65 by our standards, because they talk quite a bit about what being a Ranger used to be like, and Hamer had been a Ranger since before the days of, you know, the Mexican Civil War and Pancho Villa and right. all that stuff, and it is. I mean, if you read what being a Ranger and trying to control the border of Texas was like at that time, it's pretty hair-raising.
Did they wish they had a wall?
I don't know that they were even considering that. the wall was the Rangers at that time, I guess.
And maybe we want to come back to this, but just while we're on the Texas Rangers, I assume at some point the Rangers are brought back, because I definitely grew up with Walker, Texas Ranger on TV.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah. Yeah, I believe the Ranger Corps was reinstated as soon as Ma Ferguson was voted out of office. Okay. I read a little bit about that. I've got a history of the Texas Rangers. I kind of went back to it and brushed up on it. I think as soon as she left office, there was like a reform candidate who tried to clean house through Texas and reinstituted the Rangers as part of, I think, part of the... It is now called, I believe, the Department of Public Safety. I've just told you everything I know about the sure. structure of law enforcement in the state of Texas, though. My wife's family could fill you in more on it, probably.
Right.
And of course, you know, they don't do cowboy stuff now. It's all karate.
Right, right. Staring down bears. Yeah, that's...
Yeah.
what'd you think of the film overall?
I really, really liked it. I thought, I think it, okay, so this is actually the, I thought of a weird commonality with the last movie we talked about, Outlaw King.
Sure.
These are both Netflix movies that have the name Methven as like kind of crucial plot stuff. So there was the Battle of Methven at the midpoint of Outlaw King, if you remember that, after all the...
Yeah.
The thistle tickling business.
Yes.
When they get ambushed in the middle of the night. That's the Battle of Methven. Henry Methven is a component of the Barrow gang in this, who is busted out of prison. He kind of accidentally joins the gang, kills a couple of people with Clyde, and it's by bringing pressure onto his family with the cooperation of like a Louisiana sheriff that they're actually able to sort of nail Bonnie and Clyde down.
Right.
That was kind of a weird coincidence, and I know about all this because Methven is my wife's maiden name, which I think I've mentioned. I really, really liked it. The director is a guy named John Lee Hancock, who directed The Founder about Ray Kroc, which came out a few years ago. What is another one of his? The Blind Side with Sandra Bullock, which got a lot of attention, I guess, about 10 years ago now. And The Alamo, the one with Billy Bob Thornton, which is one of my favorite historical movies.
I was going to say, that was a better movie than it should have been, I think.
Yeah. It's Roger Ebert said, I understand why this is getting so much critical flack. It's a good movie.
Yeah.
Something that I noticed, it's not like I seek this guy's movies out, but every time I run across them, they're really good. This has a lot in common, I think, with The Alamo, in that he really emphasizes the Texas landscape, and he shot all of this in the right kinds of places, that like East Texas piney woods in the West Louisiana, you know, that swampy territory over there. They shot the ambush in the actual place where it happened.
Oh, okay.
Which I read that somewhere and didn't really believe it, but I checked on it and found an article in Texas Monthly where they talked about it. They actually put added fake brush to narrow the road more because it's pretty wide now, and drop dirt over the whole stretch of it to cover the paving, and shot it in the actual place that it happens, which I always like that kind of thing. But I kind of have a thing for sort of dusty 1930s Depression era stuff. You know, dusty roads and fedoras just kind of hit my sweet spot somehow. So, you know, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and what's the movie with Tom Hanks? Road to Perdition. Yeah, which is really good. Same composer, incidentally. So the music, when you get lonely cars driving out Western highways with that music playing, it feels almost like a deleted kind of filler footage from Road to Perdition. But great costume design, really, really good acting. I think if the acting weren't as good as it is, it would be a very dull movie.
Yeah.
Woody Harrelson in particular. So I'm not crazy about Kevin Costner, but he's excellent in this. He's like really aged into this kind of gravitas. Like he kind of channels a little Tommy Lee Jones almost, where he's kind of this tough older guy who can tell you a lot just simply by being still,
right,
and observing things. And Woody Harrelson is really, really effective as kind of his conscience, who's been affected a lot more deeply by the kinds of stuff that they've done as Rangers than Hamer is willing to let on. So really good looking movie. I really like the way they dramatize the sort of shoe leather detective work. Really good performances, and you know, the costumes and the cars, and I especially love the guns. You know, Thompson submachine guns and Browning automatic rifles.
Yeah,
keep your AR-15s. I like stuff with a wooden stock on it.
Yeah, I think probably my favorite scene in the movie was when he Kevin Costner prepares to hunt them down by stocking up on weapons and basically buys out a gun store.
Oh, I just, you know, I get why we have these debates and conversations now, but I personally would love to be able to go into a store and say, give me that Thompson submachine gun.
Right.
Just because I like that kind of old 1930s Depression era tech. Well, same reason I love World War II stuff and The Rocketeer, things like that.
Another great historical movie, right?
Yeah. We ought to do an episode on the political implications of The Rocketeer sometime. But anyway, I also think, as a teacher, I think it'll be really useful. I show the Alamo to my History 201 classes, my U.S. history classes. Very probably I will get a DVD of this and show it, because it does illustrate a lot of what I talk about when I talk about things like the Roaring Twenties and organized crime, and kind of the development of federal policing and things like that. You know, properly preparing the class by pointing out, you know, what is and is not true and that kind of thing. But I don't know, what was your overall impression?
It was fine. I sort of the same as I thought about the Alamo. Like it was fine. For point of reference, my go-to Alamo movie is Davy Crockett. So,
yeah, gotcha.
You know, it may not be a fair comparison. not the John Wayne Alamo movie, because John Wayne should not play Davy Crockett ever.
No.
But yeah,
that movie's really about communism anyway.
Yeah, well, and
I mean, it really, like, if you watch it knowing when it was made, it's clearly like a McCarthyite thing.
Yeah, and it's a long movie, and yeah, but you know, Highwayman was fine. I thought it was kind of interesting. Like I said, I don't know the history behind it, so I can't speak to that side of it. But just as a film, I thought they did a good job kind of keeping the plot interesting. It's an action-free movie, which, you know, is appropriate for a movie with a couple of elderly guys as the leads, even if they're maybe not in reality as elderly as they looked, which means that a lot more of it had to be carried on by dialogue and facial appearances and expressions and so on, which again, I think they did an excellent job with. And they did a good job of hammering, using the plot to express their themes in a way that wasn't in your face, but still got across what I think they were trying to get across, which some of what we're going to get into, you know, the glorification of villains and the glorifications of lawmen and pop culture. The short answer is I thought it was fine. Glad I watched it. I probably will not be showing it in class, but I don't teach U.S. history, so It makes sense. This, I suppose this might be fair game. We show a movie every semester just as a department. So we take an evening and we give extra credit for students, and one of the professors gives a little talk or leads a discussion at the end. So this might be fair game for that.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
I guess we haven't done a rated R movie yet, and you know, we are a Baptist school, so yeah. We'll see. We'll have to see how that
goes.
Well,
this is other than the just like explosion of violence at the end, it's a pretty... It could almost pass for PG-13. There's almost no language in it.
Right.
Zero sex, mercifully. Kevin Costner keeps his pants on.
Sure.
Something he was not known to do back in the 90s.
Right. And I'll be interested. I would imagine ratings are going to have to change now that so many more movies are coming out through these streaming services, and Amazon's making movies, and Netflix is making movies, and that's going to have to affect the way ratings are done. But anyway, that's conversation for another time. So you've got on the outline here glorification of villains and lawmen and pop culture, and then invocations of Robin Hood, which they do in the movie. But can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Really briefly, just I've kind of touched on this before, but the movie is pretty broadly accurate. We'll maybe talk about some other stuff as we come by, but one of the problems with the movie, and it's something that I think they exploit pretty well thematically in the movie, is that a lot of the people who were involved in this stuff just didn't talk it up. They were not glory hounds, which is rather pointedly driven home at the very end of the movie. So right. you get the ambush of Bonnie and Clyde outside Arcadia, New Orleans, or excuse me, Arcadia, Louisiana, at the end of the movie. And true to life, the guys involved don't talk about it. They're kind of sickened to be offered money to discuss what they've just done. The result is that a lot of what we know about it comes from very scanty police reports, and then kind of memoirs and recollections like 20, 30, 40 years later, which is interesting because Ted Hinton, the young guy at the ambush scene at the end, he's the last one of those guys left alive and says a lot of things that kind of severely muddy the waters about the exact sequence of some of the events at the end. But they condense a lot of stuff. Because you've basically, you know, if you made this movie 100% historically accurate, it'd mostly be Hamer driving around by himself for like 3 or 4 months, then picking up Galt a couple of times, and then bringing him on with a couple of other guys for the very final shootout. So they do a good job of making this story cinematic, as you were just saying. So major recurring theme through the movie is like the way Bonnie and Clyde themselves are glorified, at their time in the media. So I'll go ahead and recommend this book. It's called Public Enemies, America's Greatest Crime Wave and the Birth of the FBI, 1933-34. It's by a writer named Brian Burrow, who's written a couple of very good true crime books, including one about like the Weathermen and other kind of radical leftist terrorists in the 1970s when there were a surprisingly huge number of terrorist bombings from domestic terrorists.
Right.
But Public Enemies is the basis of the movie Public Enemies, which we've already dumped on a little bit, or that I've already dumped on. The movie Public Enemies focuses almost entirely on Dillinger. The book covers John Dillinger and his gang, Pretty Boy Floyd, Machine Gun Kelly, the Barkers, Alvin Karpis, and the Bonnie and Clyde gang. It's really, really well-researched deep dive into a period of approximately 16 months when all of these groups either were arrested and put away for life or killed, many of them killed. So that's a really, really good one, and helps kind of contextualize a lot of what we're talking about. Bonnie and Clyde, I bring that up because Bonnie and Clyde kind of benefit from some of the glory surrounding guys like Dillinger, who does have a little bit more dash and I don't want to say chivalry, but he's easier to romanticize. He does display a certain kind of Errol Flynn courtesy when he's jacking up banks, doesn't wantonly kill people. There are guys, Pretty Boy Floyd does some stuff like, you know, handing out money to poor people, that kind of thing. Bonnie and Clyde are just two-bit hoods who kill people.
Jordan.
Like
or police officers.
And state troopers, right? You know, because they're swimming in the dough. The movie does a good job, though, of kind of tearing them down to size, which is entirely appropriate. And Burrow, who's a pretty sensible, staid writer and reporter of these things in his book, does not stint in his criticism. He calls them, you know, lazy drifters, two-bit thugs. You know, they have a reputation for robbing banks, which poor people in the Depression kind of understandably sympathize with. But mostly they rob convenience stores and pharmacies and grocery stores. They kill a couple of like gas station attendants and stuff like that. If they are approached by cops, they shoot first, which you see dramatized a couple of times in the movie. Not always accurately, but broadly correctly. The second incident where you see them gun down some cops in the movie actually gets kind of absurd by the end. One of the cops is killed outright. The other is wounded. They make him get up and try to get their car unstuck from a mud hole with him, and actually are flagging down motorists to help them get out while there's this dead state trooper in the road. They're pretty pathetic and pitiful people, but the notoriety that rubs off on them from some other interstate criminals kind of gives them some panache. They're also good self-promoters. Bonnie famously writes this kind of doggerel poetry that she submits to newspapers. Clyde, you know, plays up some of his notoriety as well. All of this really takes off, though, in the 1960s, long after they're dead, when the movie Bonnie and Clyde comes out, in which they are clearly recast as kind of like figures of the youth counterculture of the late 1960s. This is 1967, so a year before Tet. The hippies haven't quite taken off yet, but you've got a kind of hip youth counterculture that's suspicious of the man and the authorities, and they cast Faye Dunaway and Warren Beatty to play them, right? I have not actually seen that movie. Have you?
No, I haven't seen that one yet. I say yet as if I'm going to watch it.
Yeah, I am honestly not interested in it. I have seen the ambush scene, which is grossly inaccurate and really, really ridiculously over the top. Apparently, they also do some weird sexual stuff with Bonnie and Clyde because it's the 60s, right? But that's kind of what actually creates their legend. By the 1960s, they're kind of forgotten, but that gives them a huge boost through media, through pop culture, as it's written down in our notes. And that's kind of been sustained ever since then. Interestingly, Frank Hamer is a character in the 1960s movie. They include a completely fictitious scene in which Bonnie and Clyde surprise him, take him hostage, and just kind of humiliate him. So the movie heavily suggests that the reason Hamer shoots first in the ambush in which Bonnie and Clyde are killed is just because he was personally humiliated by them, which never happened, and his widow sued the pants off of Warner Brothers and won when the movie came out. Sure. So, yeah. I don't know. What would you add to that? I think the movie does a good job of kind of showing the way some nasty people can be idolized at the time. And, of course, we've got all this subsequent history since then. I don't know. What are your observations?
Yeah, obviously, Hamer and Galt are not okay with the romanticization that seems to be going on. At least they play it up as if it's happening during their lifetime, which sounds like that was more of a 60s thing than a 30s thing. But
there is a lot of it during their lifetime. I mean, it is true. They mention at the end that Bonnie and Clyde's funerals were attended by 15,000 and 20,000 right. people. So that celebrity is true, but it dissipates pretty quickly.
Right. So clearly they're disgusted with that. But there's also some there is some disconnect. So obviously Hamer is well off. And it can be, I thought one of the more jarring parts of the movie was him driving his wife's brand new Ford, shiny, obviously a very affluent individual's vehicle through the slums, right? Through the, I guess, would they have been called Hoovervilles still at that point?
I don't know. They visit a couple of refugee camps. They may have been called Hoovervilles. Bonnie and Clyde's neighborhood is called the Bog.
Right.
I don't know if they. I can't remember if they actually say that in the movie or not. But that's the area outside Dallas where they were from.
I mean, there's definitely some visual sympathy, if we are going to take the side of the poor and the downtrodden. There is some visual sympathy with at least the neighborhood Bonnie and Clyde are from. And right. The character whose name I'm blanking on, the young deputy who's helping them ID Bonnie and Clyde. Also obviously has some sympathy for them. If only because he knew them when they were growing up and they were, you know, all lived in the same town and were in the same class and so on. There's that scene with Clyde's father, whose last name is Barrow, but whose first name I'm forgetting, where he and Hamer have this conversation about, you know, is Clyde really responsible personally for his actions, or did, you know, the man kind of beat this into him? And it is an open-ended conversation. At least for the viewer. I mean, I don't think Hamer comes away thinking that it's been open-ended. But, you know, for us watching it, there is at least some question of, you know, did Clyde Barrow get set on this path because of something internal to him? You know, is he just a bad person, or was he hounded by the police so much when he was growing up that he became a bad person? And there's at least some wiggle room there, according to the movie. Now, I'm being a good Calvinist, I'm going to say no, he was just a bad person. And a good person in those circumstances wouldn't have killed a bunch of people.
Right.
But, you know, that's just maybe me being a Calvinist, bringing that out.
well, I'm not a Calvinist, and I agree.
Right. Well, give it time, Jordan. Give it time. I think there is something, but I think the other side of that, right? I'm not entirely sure this movie is glorifying lawmen either.
No.
Although I suppose it depends on what you want to see in a lawman. So clearly, yeah. Hamer and Galt are both highly competent, and even taking into account for their age, there are a number of satisfying, you know, beating up the bad guys scenes. There aren't many of them for an action movie, but there's a couple, and it is really satisfying when they do it. But we also have that incredibly brutal and bloody end scene, which we've alluded to that a few times. We should probably just go ahead and explain that. Do you want to tell us what happens in the last scene of the movie? You know, spoiler alert for.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in case you somehow don't know what happens to Bonnie and Clyde. So the way all of this finally pans out, Hamer and Galt, just with good old-fashioned detective work, nicely pitted against the pencil-neck FBI guys, which I kind of enjoyed. They don't do a ton with that, but there's some interesting history there. Just doing the good old-fashioned detective work, figure out that if they can't go to ground in Dallas because the net is cast too wide there, they will hide out with the family of one of their gang members. And the only guy with them at the time that this takes place is Henry Methvin. His family is in West Louisiana, so they head there to check it out in Bienville Parish. They scope out the local sheriff to see if he's in on it because, again, they make a crack that my Texan wife found very hilarious and satisfying about how not that hard to find corrupt cops in Louisiana. They test the waters with the sheriff, a guy named Henderson Jordan, who Burrow in his book actually thinks is the kind of prime mover behind the ambush. But just to give you a little bit of a hint of how sketchy some of our details are on all this. Just almost every aspect of the kind of final couple of days of this is open to interpretation. So having cooperating with Texas authorities, getting a kind of verbal guarantee that Henry Methvin can get off the hook specifically in Texas for some of his crimes, although not in places like Oklahoma where he's also killed people. Hamer and Galt and Jordan bring Henry Methvin's father, a guy named a kind of layabout drunk named Ivy, into the picture, and through you know, kind of insinuation and kind of offering him the one chance to save his son's life that is probably going to be available to him, to get him to cooperate with them, figure out that Bonnie and Clyde are on their way to see the Methvins in Louisiana. There's only one way in and out of their final destination, so they lay an ambush there. And again, the sources are, you know, they were there anywhere from 24 to 48 or more hours waiting. They set up a roadblock where Ivy Methvin has his truck up on a jack with a tire taken off as if he's broken down, just something to get them to slow down and look. And again, Bonnie and Clyde have shot first and blown their way out of a number of roadblocks before. It's worth pointing out, Clyde's favorite weapon is the Browning automatic rifle, which is kind of an antique nowadays, but that's serious firepower, like military grade firepower, right, back then. It's 30-06, 20 round magazine fires. It's got select fire. It's got two different automatic fire settings. It is nothing to joke around with, and he carries three. When they empty the car after the ambush, there's 2,000 rounds of loaded magazines for the BAR in there. So they know what they're getting themselves into. They set up this ambush. They've got six men in a hide. When they come along, Hinton is able to identify them from a distance. Hamer and Galt step out into the road and flag them down. Hamer says, "Stick them up," which interestingly is his last word in the whole movie.
Right.
Costner has no more dialogue after that, and I think that's really brilliantly done. There's this brief moment of these people just making eye contact, and then Bonnie and Clyde go for their guns, and the posse just opens up on them. Galt actually fires first, which is interesting thematically, although it's disputed who actually did it in real life. Where there's all this dispute, they just make the most thematic and character-driven artistic choices, which I think is fine given how confusing our details are. And that they just unleash this like fusillade on the car. The number from real life, they fired anywhere between 130 and 150 rounds into the car. Just blew Bonnie and Clyde to pieces. And then the final movie where you get the real stinger is, interestingly, the sole sympathy I feel like the movie really offers to Bonnie and Clyde as people is after they're dead, right? Because their car is towed into town with their bodies still in the front seat, and these maniacal mobs are reaching into the car, trying to take pieces of it, trying to grab locks of Bonnie's hair. They don't include it in the movie, but in real life, a guy actually took his pocket knife out and tried to saw off Clyde's ear as a souvenir. That would probably just be too much at that point, but they make the point, right? So in an interesting way, once Bonnie and Clyde are out of the picture, the kind of accusative stare of the movie is turned on the audience, which I think is kind of interesting. How's that as a recap of the end?
No, that's good. And again, I don't have a lot of sympathy for the or even really interest in kind of historical glorifications of criminals. That goes for, you know, basically criminals of whatever time. And maybe that's just my conservative disposition, but I mean, I wouldn't want you know, music pirates from the 90s to have been shot up by the, you know, Texas Rangers, but nor do I necessarily have a lot of sympathy for them either. So.
Right. Well, especially when you get, I mean, it's one thing to create Napster. It's another thing to spend like 2 years roaming aimlessly across the Midwest, robbing stores and shooting people. Because they really are aimless. It's not like they have some kind of grand plan. They're just living hand to mouth off of, like, quite literally off of other people. It's almost a parasitic existence.
Which isn't the way the movie plays them up, right? The movie, I think at one point they talk about how they're working with almost military precision, and they're being tracked by the regular patterns that they follow, and it's presented as if they are some kind of criminal masterminds. At least that was sort of...
See, I took that as just kind of like... I just took that as kind of like Hamer figuring out that the one constant is that they always come back to Dallas to see family.
Right.
But I don't know. I can totally see where you're coming
from. Well, and yeah, Hamer never said that. It was you know, the FBI guys and the Texas authorities.
Oh, gotcha.
And Hamer was very much coming at this as if these are just any other criminals, and treat them like any criminals, and we will catch them the same way we catch everyone else, using good old fashioned hard work. And Which I like one of the questions you've got on the outline here. What to do with threats that cannot be handled under the system as it stands? And that is one of the points that they make kind of regularly in the movie, is, you know, modern law enforcement with all of its methods. And they keep talking up the wiretapping and the was it air patrols and the dragnet of federal and state and local authorities all coordinating with each other. And even with all of that, they're still not really equipped to handle either the violence or the brilliance or the insanity or whatever of Bonnie and Clyde. I remember when they were talking about that, I mean, I think one of the points we're supposed to take away is they actually had been equipped to handle that. What's her name? The governor, Ma Parker, was that it? Ma Ferguson, shut down the entity that was designed to handle that sort of thing. The Texas Rangers, again, I think what we're supposed to, one of the things we're supposed to take away is they actually could deal with that sort of thing, but they get shut down.
Right.
So definitely. It's to say that the system as it stands can't handle it is true, but only because the system has shut down part of itself that is designed to handle that sort of thing.
Right, and it's done so under a kind of collective delusion that the world has moved past certain needs, right. which is very much of a part with that whole progressive and New Deal era, right? Like, we've evolved beyond that. Ma Ferguson almost says as much. I thought it was kind of funny, just because I always find people invoking the year funny, as if that matters. Right. She's like, this is 1934, you know, get with it, right? It's this kind of, you know, despite all of our grand pretensions for, you know, the scientific precision of the FBI or the kind of humane liberalism of the government, we're dealing with a threat that strips a lot of that modernity away, and we're going to have to handle it with something that's almost pre-modern, which, like you kind of said, tickles my conservative sensibilities, because I feel like, you know, there's a lot up for grabs, but there's some basic human nature stuff that does not change. But it does leave it open-ended.
Yeah, I mean, there is something to be said for maybe there is a time and a place to just hang people who commit certain kinds of crimes. Now, the other side of that, of course, is, Hamer and Galt catch and deal with Bonnie and Clyde, and Bonnie and Clyde are guilty. But if they were after someone who is not guilty, but they still believed was guilty, I don't see that ending differently. Right, mm-hmm. It's great that we have this sort of these relics that we can call on and use them when necessary. This is sort of the Die Hard or the Dirty Harry problem, right? What do you do when the system is failing? Well, you need someone to come in and beat up the bad guys and chuck them out of buildings and torture them to find out where the girl is buried or whatever. Which is fine until they take that same attitude and apply it in a situation where they are mistaken about who the bad guy is.
Right. That's a really good point. And it's hard to think about as like a hypothetical, though, because, I mean, Bonnie and Clyde, there's no question of their guilt. And Hamer basically goes back into retirement after this. This is all of his record that the movie offers us. So, other than flashbacks,
there's a little blurb at the end. It was Galt who went back to the Texas Rangers, right, when they were reformed.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And Hamer, I don't remember, just lives out his life with his wife on their plantation or whatever.
Yeah, his wife and his wild hog.
Right. Right.
Which I thought was pretty fantastic.
Oh yeah, if city code allowed it, we would have pigs. The wife is a dog person, and I am a not. But I like bacon, so I was like, well, we can have a pig, and you get a pet, and I get bacon. She was not amused, and the city doesn't allow it, so it didn't work out. But yes, I definitely see the appeal of a pet pig.
Especially if it scares away people offering you jobs you don't want.
There's that too. Although I don't have people offering me jobs I don't want either. So
true. You mean you have not been tasked with tracking down random sprinklers?
No, I've not really been tasked with anything, which is fine. I have enough to do. I think that's everything we had. You've got something on here about the necessity of federal power and oversight of interstate crimes. Did you want to talk about that a little bit?
Maybe we could just nod toward that. Again, that book, Public Enemies, does a good job of contextualizing Bonnie and Clyde. And I've watched the movie twice now. I can't remember. I feel like they name drop a few other kind of interstate criminals, but like I said, Dillinger and Machine Gun Kelly and the Barkers and a whole bunch of these other people are active at the same time, doing a lot of things similar to what Bonnie and Clyde are doing, killing a lot of people and robbing a lot of banks and stealing a lot of cars, you know, that kind of thing. And that is a, you know, if you're wondering why the FBI has the power it does now, it's because of stuff like that. One of the things that the movie brings out really well is just how highway travel changes what crime is. And when I teach the Roaring Twenties, you know, I tell my students about Bonnie and Clyde, you know, that because it's kind of a piece with organized crime from the 20s, so I just kind of roped them into that, even though they're the early 30s. But, you know, I say even a generation before Clyde, if he had tried to do the kind of stuff that he did, would have been rounded up by a posse 2 miles out of town, right, and judged by somebody like hanging Judge Parker and hanged. You know, there's a sense in which, you know, things like automotive technology and, you know, the burgeoning state and state highway systems make what they do possible, which is interpreted by some people as requiring a larger interstate response, right? If the Louisiana State Police and the Texas Rangers can't handle this, then we need some supra-state agency that will handle it, and that's where the FBI steps into that in the movie. And there's a lot of I think you get a little sense of it from the movie, but the FBI with Hoover in charge, who's going to be a law enforcing ghoul for the next 30 years, right, or almost 40, he is going to use this to he's really going to, you know, one of the reasons Bonnie and Clyde were so famous at the time is because guys like Hoover played up their activities to justify the creation of a federal agency like the FBI, which of course has left us a really mixed bag legacy.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, what would be the alternative to something like the FBI would be increased interstate cooperation and coordination, right?
Which is what Hamer does.
It is, and again, that's that is a bigger logistical problem that I, again, as conservative, I wish the states had done, but practically, that, you know, if so, Missouri touches 8 other states, right? That's a huge task to say, hey, coordinate your law enforcement agency with 8 other law enforcement agencies. Certainly easier in one sense, just to coordinate with one, with the FBI.
Right, but of course, then you know, and of course, that gives you all those nice jurisdictional disputes in movies like Die Hard.
Right, sure. Well, and it, I mean, this is beyond the scope of this movie, but it leads to reevaluations of, you know, interpretations of things like the Bill of Rights. So I know one of the big cases in the early 30s, and I don't remember what year it is, but it's a case that has to do with searching without a warrant. Right? Can you search someone's car? Specifically if they're running booze, right? If during Prohibition, maybe this is the '20s. Can you search someone's car without a warrant? Well, if you say no to that, and if the police officer has to go and get a warrant, that's just going to give them time to dump the booze, right? So what are we supposed to do? And the Chief Justice, William Howard Taft, says, yeah, look, in that circumstance, as long as the officer has probable cause, as long as he has a reasonable suspicion that there's booze there, he can look. And you know, that is a major change in our interpretation of you know, the constitutional requirement for getting a warrant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
right, and has also left us a mixed list.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that is specifically because of the automobile and the interstate highway system. You would never have had to have worried about that with a train, for example, or with a even with a, you know, horse and buggy. You don't have the same kinds of issues.
Right.
Anything else out of this movie?
I included a quote from C.S. Lewis in our show notes. I didn't know if I could drop it in somewhere or not. This might be a good place. It's from an essay he wrote in 1943, which is just 9 years after the events depicted in this movie, which I think is interesting. You can find this essay. It's called Equality. I believe it was published in The Spectator. It's in a collection of his essays called Present Concerns, which is interesting because it's newspaper kind of op-eds, so it's Lewis being topical, which you don't really get from a lot of his other books. But he's writing in defense of the democratic concept of equality, but he does make a point in passing about the, you know, kind of the proper orientation of people's moral compasses. And so, you know, talking about, you know, yeah, you can remove kings, you can establish democratic systems of government, but you've always got to be attuned to the inherent dangers of homo religiosus, right? So the little block is a little block that I pulled out is where men are forbidden to honor a king, they honor millionaires, athletes, or film stars instead, even famous prostitutes or gangsters. for spiritual nature, like bodily nature, will be served. Deny it food, and it will gobble poison. So whenever you see the, I think the kind of attention and the worshipfulness lavished on people like Bonnie and Clyde, you're seeing some kind of evidence of a spiritual hunger that's not being filled in a properly oriented way.
Right, and that's part of the nature of democracy, right? We're going to anyone who we should be appropriately honoring or respecting, we're going to pull down to our level, but then someone else is going to take their place. And you know,
right,
culturally I like that: millionaires, athletes, film stars, or criminals.
Which is exactly the case with
Sure. And politically, of course, it's going to be demagogues, right? Ma Ferguson and right. Huey Long and FDR. It's going to be people who would have been who are in the places of what would have been the aristocracy have now become worse versions of an aristocracy. So you don't
right. And at the time Bonnie and Clyde are killed, Hitler's been in power for 1 year in Germany, and you know Mussolini has a really good long term grip on Italy. So I mean it's Lewis knew whereof he wrote, and it's I think a perennially applicable observation.
Sure. Yeah, the big conservative writers at the beginning of the 20th century, Paul Elmer Moore and Irving Babbitt. I mean, basically everything they write is about that, right? This problem mm-hmm. of what kind of leadership are we going to have now that we have basically executed the idea of leadership? What is right. that going to mean practically, and how do we deal with that?
Right.
And there's probably a reason they're obscure writers and no one reads them, because their answers are not very democratic. How we got on democracy from Bonnie and Clyde, but there you have it.
This movie it's not the theme of the movie, but you can see the pockmarks of the disease all over.
Oh, sure. I mean the mobs of people that follow them around.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right, and the fact again that somebody like Ma Ferguson is in charge, and it's a distinctly, again, undemocratic kind of guy, not seeking the spotlight, not cooperating with the media, who is the one who actually resolves the issue.
Right. Well, anything else? Otherwise, we should wrap up.
I think that's got it. I think this is a really great movie, and people should watch it.
And I'm happy to agree with that. So, well, thank you, Jordan, for joining us, and thank you, listener, for tuning in. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filipic. Please check out other podcasts in the family and find more information about our own show or our show notes by visiting christianhumanist.org. And please do leave us a review on iTunes as well. You can like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast or send us an email at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Ed Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
Bonnie was a waitress in a small cafe. Clyde Barrow was the rounder that took her away. They both robbed and killed until both of them died. So goes the legend of Bonnie and Clyde. The poem that she wrote of the life that they led, told of the lawmen left dying or dead. Some say that Clyde made her life a shame, but the legend made Bonnie the head of the game. The rampage grew wilder with each passing day, the odds growing smaller with each getaway. With the end growing closer, the harder they fought. With blood on their hands, they were bound to get caught.